thanks. Byron gave me the topic he wanted me to talk about. Actually, all of these pretty much were his. He asked me to deal with reading realistic fantasy. And actually, that's a very good topic because it's going to pull together a lot of things they've talked about with postmodernism and reading and some scriptural issues on the arts. So I think that'll be a helpful topic. First of all, I want us to think about some of the things I said in my first talk. Notice it's the postmodernists say that truth is a construction. Okay, in other words, there's no objective truth, at least that we can know. Everything that we have in our language and things we say are true and our ideas are just constructions. Notice that there's not that much difference between truth and fiction. Right? Fiction is when we make up a story. Well, if our nonfiction, if when we're talking about true things, that's something we make up too. So ultimately, truth and fiction become very closely related. It becomes hard to tell the difference between truth and fiction. And ultimately, everything is fictional, according to the postmodernist. What does that do, say, for politics? Okay. The people who come out of the great universities of our day and in the mainstream of contemporary thought, if they believe there's no difference between truth and fiction, how does that relate to how we maybe take them, take what they say, believe what they say? Very interesting article saying that President Clinton is our first postmodern president. This article is by Robert J. Lifton, who wrote that book, The Protean Self, talking about a postmodern psychology. And he was saying this is a good thing. Okay, this is why he likes Clinton, because Clinton is a postmodern president. He's continually reinventing himself. Okay. He's not limited to one version of the truth. It's interesting that Lifton wrote this a year or so before the latest scandals have come out. It's very interesting to look at these scandals and how they're being handled by the White House. Allegations that the president had a sexual affair with a White House intern. Well, notice the spin. Because in the postmodern world, everything is spun different ways so that we can interpret it in different ways. Instead of looking at what happened, what does it mean, what do we do with it, everything is interpreted. Well, what do you mean by sexual relationship? Okay. Notice taking language and cutting it up so fine until you have almost nothing left. Different ways of interpreting these events, these facts. You get new explanations one day, then when that's shot down, another explanation. Now, what about the other explanation yesterday? Is that not true? Were you not telling the truth? Well, truth is not an issue for postmodernists. Truth claims are continually remade, put out so that different interpretations, the public can interpret that in a more favorable way. And that's the remarkable thing as we look at the postmodern present. I mean, the old way, even the modernist way, would say, well, somebody says one thing, And then it doesn't seem to be true. That's a lie. Okay. Some people look at our president in terms of lying. Okay. That's the pre-modern way of looking at things, or even a modern way. But the postmodernists, it doesn't seem to bother them. And that shows the extent that postmodernism has swept through our whole culture. Opinion polls show that, well, most of the public, they buy it. Okay? It doesn't buy. And again, President Clinton is a postmodern president. Notice the way with truth. Notice the way with interpret. Notice, again, not worrying about being consistent. Because postmodernists, you don't have to be consistent. You're continually reinventing yourself. Yeah. So again, if truth and fiction are both about the same, what does that do to the news? Okay, you watch the news on television. Okay, it will factor in a little bit of the pop culture, a little bit of what we've talked about with images and television. Notice how news is becoming more and more indistinguishable from entertainment. Okay, notice the news stories that they cover. Okay, another massacre in Bosnia, followed by Madonna's latest album. Okay. Notice they're both presented as the same kind of thing. Even the handling of serious news, often, many people have been pointing out, it's done for the entertainment value. You know, on a TV show, on a news show, you've got half an hour and you just have a few stories and just a few minutes at most to deal with any one story. What kind of depth are you going to be able to get anyway with that medium? Plus, they have to get ratings so people will watch them. Again, that's what drives TV. So it's very interesting to see the few stories they select every night. And again, the spin they put on the different stories presenting for their entertainment value. Even in newspapers, we're seeing this. Have you heard about the recent kind of scandal in journalism? One of the big reporters for the New Republic, a big liberal magazine, it turns out he was writing all these stories, and it turned out he was making them up. Okay. He didn't really talk to any of these people. These people didn't even exist. Well, the postmodern journalist. Again, they fired him. I think they should have given him a raise. You know, he's simply being the consistent postmodernist journalist. The other issue on CNN and Time Magazine, nerve gas used in Vietnam. America, again, bringing back that old image of America as an evil place, that we use nerve gas on during the Vietnam War. Well, it turns out that, you know, no, we didn't. Even the sources that the journalists talked to said, well, we never said that. It was a construction. It was a construction on CNN, picked up by Time Magazine. It fit the image that they wanted to portray. Just a little fact is, it's not true. But again, remember, as you read the media, as you watch television, the postmodern age, you can't necessarily believe what you're told. Or rather, what you're told is the very people who are doing it see it as a construction. In other words, truth and fiction get badly confused today. And you see this in other areas, in history. The whole phenomenon in the history field of revisionist history of one kind or another, taking something historical and putting a new spin on it. You know, for example, in feminist history, the big thing is that, well, yes, we have all these patriarchal cultures, but before the patriarchal cultures were matriarchal cultures. So those ancient Celts, women ruled, and the goddess worship was a much more liberating... Well, classical historians, what can I say? No, no, it wasn't. These were really matriarchal, and if they were, they treated women worse than anybody. And the feminists say, well, but women today need a model of history that will affirm them. Again, did it happen? Was it there? Well, no, but the view of history, of scholarship, is something constructed to fit the ideological needs of current victims. You see that over and over and over in history departments in the universities today. And but again, that's an implication of the postmodernist confusion between what's fictional and what's true, and saying that what the realm of truth is also something that we can make fiction about. Yeah. So I want to say some things though about postmodernist fiction. Okay. I want to talk about some of the contemporary writing that's being done today. And in my talk, I'm going to go from the very contemporary to the very old, and kind of jump back and forth. You know, modernist fiction was very realistic. In the 20th century, the writers, they're important, Hemingway, Faulkner, Steinbeck, notice they were trying to be very realistic, very much, very descriptive, very accurate. They were trying to make their fiction as realistic as possible. Of course, that fit the modernist worldview. What's real is what we can see, is what's tangible, and so even when they're writing fiction, they were trying to make it in terms of what's tangible and what you might see, and to render their writing with great accuracy or realism, as that movement was called. It's interesting that the postmodern writers are reacting against that realism, as you would expect. The postmodernists are saying, well, okay, Hemingway is telling a really realistic story, but it's still just made up. Okay, it didn't really happen as he's writing it. When you're writing fiction, you're making things up. And it seems realistic because Hemingway is following certain conventions, certain techniques of realistic writing. So when you read it, it really seems like it's happening, although it's actually totally imaginary. Okay. And so the postmodern authors are saying, well, since fiction is something that's made up, and here you realistic writers are following these conventions, really you don't have to be realistic. And fantasy elements have come back in contemporary literature. Maybe that's a healthy thing. I think the modernists were kind of getting in a rut, and some of the more contemporary writers are now seeing that fantasy is good. It's realistic fiction was just made up. It's an imaginary thing and isn't really true. Why not, you know, go for it? You know, why not really make up really wild things that could never happen, but you're not saying they could happen? So a whole genre of fantasy, you know, science fiction, has a new respectability. And the modernists looked down on it because it wasn't realistic. People still enjoyed it, some great science fiction writers. But now, I think this is a healthy thing. It's respectable again. Okay? There's a new openness to fantasy, fiction, different kinds. Now, the postmodernist writers, though, of course, as you would expect, tend to go further and further. There are a number of very interesting styles. Now, along with the kind of the new focus on pop culture, a lot of the postmodernist writers of the high culture, the really serious writers, they're doing things like taking kind of popular forms and bringing those into their so-called serious writing, trying to break the boundary between the pop culture and the high culture. And so you have very serious, distinguished writers writing westerns, for example, writing mysteries, writing romance novels, writing science fiction. Remember, a lot of the pop genres tend to follow formulas, as we said. So now a lot of the more sophisticated writers of high culture are taking those formulas and following them too, only they're writing in a more complex way, but they're still following the formulas. Again, the idea that these are conventions that even the realistic writers are using, so let's play with the conventions. Again, the result is kind of interesting. Larry McMurtry, serious writer, and then the result, he writes a book like Lonesome Dove, great Western novel by a great, skillful writer, a genre that people look down upon. Now he's breathed new life into it. And that's a good thing. Umberto Eco, big postmodernist writer, writing mysteries. A medieval Name of the Rose, for example, you may have read that. And again, it does make literature, I think, there's a fun, entertainment value in a lot of the more serious contemporary novels than there was. I think a lot of the modernists had gotten so realistic and, of course, so negative because of their bleak worldview. It's just a chore to read through them. And so there's some more vitality, I think, in a lot of contemporary literature. But another style, though, that you see is a very self-conscious attempt, though, to blur the distinction. I mean, some say this is just a story and let's have fun with it and let's see what we can do with it. Others are self-consciously trying to look at that boundary between what we think is fact and fiction and kind of trying to confuse things. For example, now you have what's called the nonfiction novel. Okay? The nonfiction novel. Here, writers are writing about true events in the form of fiction. Truman Capote started this with In Cold Blood. He took an actual murder case in Kansas, and he talked to the killers and the victims and everybody and followed the trial, and he wrote it in a narrative form. And so you read that, you have a whole case of the crime, the arrest, the punishment, the execution of the killers, told from the inside, using techniques of fiction, only he's using them for nonfiction. You know, it's kind of interesting. I happen to love historical novels. I love to get my novels, or get my history by reading a novel about it, because it really puts me inside the time and the characters. And a lot of the contemporary writers are doing a lot with it. Of course, you see the problem. Sometimes writers doing this end up, it's more actually fiction than truth. A lot of the writers are writing about things that actually happen and taking us inside the minds. There was a book on, I think Robert Kennedy, written this way, and in it he gives us the thoughts of Robert Kennedy as he's facing it. Now, wait a minute. he doesn't know the thoughts of this person. It's clearly being totally made up, and yet it purports to give us an account of what happened. You see this in movies, Oliver Stone movies. He writes about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Of course, he believes in a conspiracy theory and that Kennedy was killed by the military-industrial complex and the CIA and Lyndon Johnson. And so he presents this historical account, but in it he's showing the CIA and the military being responsible. Well, my wife teaches high school in the Milwaukee school. She says that a lot of her students, they talk about the Kennedy assassination, that's what they believe. Okay? That's what they believe happened. That, yeah, the military killed Kennedy because they saw the movie. Again, fact and fiction becoming confused. Many children today point out their views of American history come from movies like Pocahontas. it happened right here, I guess, in this area. You get a total distortion of the real Pocahontas, what she did, and the explorers, and of course she became a Christian, but none of that is in the movie. You know, you see a Native American Barbie doll, and that's the image, and that's the history that is projected. Yeah. Another style that's very popular, kind of interesting and fun, and yet can kind of be kind of confusing, is a style called magical realism. Okay, magical realism. What this is a mixture of very realistic writing combined with total fantasy, and putting them in the same book, or in the same movie, or the same TV show. Started by a Latin American writer, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, very good writer. And it's so odd to read him because he'll be so realistic and gritty. He's writing, he's from, I think, Colombia, and he'll be writing about a woman who's hanging up the laundry. And you have the feel of that village in South America. She's hanging up the laundry on the line, and all of a sudden she ascends into heaven. What? Where did that come from? Again, mix it. He had another character who's a Latin American dictator, and he's involved with a really complicated thing, and he's just sitting there and he's cutting out pieces of paper as he's thinking about his problem, cutting out butterflies. And all of a sudden, the scraps of paper start flying around the room. They start getting in the fingers, knocking them down, and finally throws them again. They plaster against the wall. Where the butt paper starts to fly around? Yeah. But what he's doing is combining realism with fantasy. He's very, very realistic because he's using the conventions of realistic fiction, which Hemingway and Steinbeck and all the others were using, the modernists. But then, at the same time, he's throwing in these fantasy elements, and it's kind of an odd experience for readers because you're all set, you're in the gears for realism, and then he hits you with something totally, totally off the wall, and it's kind of a It's kind of interesting, actually. Yeah, it's kind of well done. But again, you see the worldview behind it, don't you? That blending, the idea that there's not a firm line between what's factual and what's utterly made up. And he's playing with that. He's playing with their minds. Magical realism has been picked up by Hollywood and by television. You see it in commercials a lot now. I was just noticing hotel room lady to look for examples. You know, you'll be watching a commercial. You see a guy get into his easy chair, recline back, and watch TV. All of a sudden, the chair starts to drive out the house, onto the highway, with his dog doing things. And again, combine the realism of sitting back in your chair, and all of a sudden, all these totally outlandish things happen. Beer commercials do this a lot. I think I know why. If you consume too many of their products, I think fact and fantasy maybe do kind of get blended, but you'll see they're out in an old filling station under the hot suns, open the bottle, and it starts snowing. And beautiful women come out of wells, and there's a beach party, and yeah. It's magical realism. And notice that we don't question it. We don't say, oh yeah, you know, that could happen. We, in our postmodern mind, we accept anything. And it doesn't. We don't even see the conflict. Some great movies using this. I think of Groundhog Day, for example. Examples are kind of old, but where time just starts repeating, okay, the same day over and over and over. It's a good movie. I really like it. But it's an example of magical realism. Now, the way the modernists would handle time travel, for example, would be to make a time machine. Okay. They would make a machine that would take you back in time so that you could live over and over if that's what the story was. There would be some explanation given, however off the wall, however impossible, but they would feel a need to give some kind of semi-rational explanation for it. That you don't need that anymore. It just happens. Oh, time is repeating for this guy. Yeah, okay, interesting. I wonder if that'll happen to me. But again, in the postmodernist world, the best examples of postmodernism recently in the movies, another good movie I think is The Truman Show. Notice that you have a character who thinks everything is real, but actually isn't. He's actually a character in a TV show. He doesn't know it. You notice how that questions and makes us question in a good way, perhaps, but it makes us question what's real and what's made up. In other words, if you were the main character in a TV show right now, would you know it? I don't know. And the Truman Show, notice the different levels of reality that are set up. Yeah, that's very postmodern. It ties into another style, often called a metafiction. Okay, metafiction. Metafiction is fiction about fiction. A lot of the postmodernist writers will write stories within stories, and stories with all these different levels of reality. Stories where maybe a writer is saying, I am now writing a story. I'm writing a story about a man, and then he makes up the story. But then it's about a writer making up the story that we're reading. And then in that, it turns out, you get the idea. A good example I read recently is called The Mystery of M. Drood. It takes an actual literary text. So Charles Dickens, when he died, was writing a mystery story, and when he died, he never finished it. And so you don't know who did it. And scholars love to study that and try to speculate, well, who probably did this crime? Anyway, in this story, he's imagining all of the detectives of fiction coming to a big convention. the Sherlock Holmes, Hillary Queen, all of the fictional characters from other books, and they're having a convention and they're going to solve Dickens' mystery. And so that's one level, this convention. Of course, they're all fictional characters too, but it somehow seems kind of real, you know, area this real level. And then the book, it prints a chapter from Dickens' actual novel. Then the next chapter is the characters talking about it and trying to analyze it. And then it keeps going. It's kind of fun. But then the characters, you know, Sherlock Holmes, enter Dickens' story. You'll be reading Dickens and all of a sudden you'll see Ellery Queen sneaking around behind a bush. And so you set up all these levels and then have then connect them in different ways in kind of ways, and then anyway it ends tying to Dickens' own life, and you have these other levels. Again, these are examples of metafiction, and but again, what it does when you finish one of those, is this really happening, or wait a minute, it's not really happening because this is all made up, this is all a novel, and it one function is to confuse those levels. Now, the whole issue of realism or fantasy hinges on there are a lot of issues involved there. For example, realism, notice it hinges on what you think is real. Okay. What you think is real, or what the author thinks is real, is going to condition the kind of realism that is written. Okay. Now, the modernists were being realistic, but they ended up kind of leaving out of consideration realities such as moral truths or spiritual truths. In the modernist mind, they just wanted to focus on what you see. They're being realistic, although for a Christian, you know, you might say, well, are they realistic at all? They're leaving out the most important realities. Okay, reality is a lot bigger than they think it is. It's a lot broader, more mysterious than a lot of the so-called realistic writers assume. Now, Christian writing has a tradition of Christian fantasy. There's also a tradition of Christian realism. And, you know, again, both of those are rich possibilities. You can write interesting Christian writing in these different forms. Realism. For example, in the latest world, I just did a big story on Larry Wywoody, he was a big, high art, very acclaimed young writer in New York City, writing, getting all the literary prizes and writing the New Yorker, and he became a Christian. Not only that, he became a Calvinist. And he's an elder in the OPC now, very well, he was the... Now, he's on the board of some of the organizations I think represented here. But he, as a writer, he is a realist. He's a hyper-realist. He's so realistic that a lot of Christians have trouble reading his work. You know, a lot of us believe in total depravity, but boy, when we see it, it's written about, it can be kind of shocking, right? Even though, you know, isn't that what we expect? But he doesn't hold anything back in his writing. And he writes about the human heart at its ugliest, as well as some of the very beautiful things in nature and in the world, and about human struggle. And he's so honest that it's refreshing, I think, because so much, even if Christian writing has seems kind of fake sometimes, Larry Wywoody, But it's interesting, he's very critical of fantasy. He's very critical that Christians today tend to prefer fantasy to realistic writing. And he says, hey, as Christians, we should base reality. I mean, that's our realm. You know, what we believe is true. And he's very much against escapism of any kind. And he says a lot of Christian readers are escaping in a nice fantasy little world instead of confronting the actual world that God has made, that God has redeemed, and that we need to live in and face. He's even critical of C.S. Lewis. He likes Lewis's ideas, but he doesn't like Lewis's fantasy. You might read what he says in if you get a copy of that World, a very interesting interview, very interesting perspective. I don't know if I don't totally agree with that at all. There is a room for Christian fantasy, and I want to talk about that. But keep in mind the possibilities of Christian realism. I think that's a very good vein to mine, and there's a great tradition of that. Flannery O'Connor is a dramatic example. I guess she's kind of painful to read sometimes, but boy, she doesn't water anything down. Read O'Connor, start with The Violent Bear It Away. Some of her stories, it's hard to even realize what she's doing. Start with that. It's a short novel, The Violent Bear It Away. And you have a great clash of worldviews between a fire and brimstone backwoods prophet and a modern school psychologist. And they're both contending for the soul of this young boy. Anyway, it's good, but it's strong stuff. That's a tradition that goes back through the 19th century, through the great writer, social realists, Dickens and Trollope and through Jane Austen and many other fine writers. I think that Wywood maybe has a point. We shouldn't just read fantasy. We should explore this too. In the Reformed tradition, there's a real aesthetic tradition of realism. You certainly see that in the Dutch Reformed painters. Painting ordinary objects. Piece of fruit, glass, it's real. I know for a Christian, just if something is real, boy, that's something God has made. I'm doing a book right now on the Hudson River artist. The first real American school of artists. And they are known for these tremendous landscapes. These big paintings of nature. They just fill you with awe. These mountains that just go back until you're just lost in light. I always looked at them as romantics, but I found they were actually Reformed Christians. And the foundation that Anthony did this research on their religious beliefs, and they had some interesting things that they wrote about how their faith related to their painting. Notice they weren't painting realistic or religious subjects. They were motivated in their stance to the secular scene, if you want to call nature that. They're motivated by their faith. They would say things like, nature is God's art. We shouldn't be painting human art. What are we? We're totally depraved. But God made nature. The beauties of nature are God's art. And what they were trying to do is to capture God's art to help us see these beauties that God builds in the creation. It's a very profound and rich line of thought. But there is a tradition for fantasy. And it's biblically based, I think. Consider the commandment that we talked about last time about graven images. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven images or any likeness of anything in heaven or on earth or under the earth or in the sea. Okay. Now, if that relates to art, what is it talking about? Is it talking about fantasy? Or is it talking about likenesses of things? Okay. Now, if anything, it's addressing realistic art, isn't it? Likenesses. I mean, there's a whole tradition, of course, in the pagan culture, certainly in the Greeks, of art as mimesis. Art as imitation. Okay, art is supposed to imitate the physical world. Well, now, if someone were to take that commandment really strictly, it seems to address imitation. Does that mean it excludes art? No. It doesn't say anything about art that isn't realistic, or art that isn't a likeness of anything on heaven or earth or under the sea. The Bible doesn't forbid realistic art either. I'm going to deal with that tomorrow morning when I talk about visual arts and how images can be used in a positive way. But it was taken certainly in among the Hebrews very literally. When you look at the pottery of the ancient Hebrews, you know, most of the Greek pottery filled with drawings of people and animals and all these beautiful pictures. Hebrew art, the paintings or the pottery decorations are pure design, colors and shapes intricately tied together, beautiful. But there's no images in them, there's no likenesses of anything in them. The Middle Eastern art, Islamic art, notice the. They take that very literally to this very day, and they will not make art that looks like anything. They make these beautiful carpets and mosaics and patterns, and it's just bright, wild colors and shapes and forms intertwining. And of course, a lot of it is calligraphy. In other words, taking the letters of language, letters of their Quran, and taking those and then putting those in these incredibly intricate interlocked shapes. Again, that's a tradition that grew out of that forbidding of images. And so it's possible to have art that's pure aesthetics, pure beauty, that isn't even of anything necessarily. No, I think that opens the door to art without likenesses. Eventually to fantasy. Now, one of the reasons I think a lot of the Christian artists turn to fantasy very early is the issue of how do you portray spiritual truth? How can you portray what can't be seen? And one of the ways that they discovered that you could do that is by means of symbol. Symbol. And so by the use of symbolism, it's a way to bring down to earth in a tangible form so we can reflect on it spiritual issues. There's a rich allegorical tradition that's at the root, I think, of much Christian fantasy. Dante, for example. Dante, what a great, great writer. Again, one can fault certainly his medieval Catholicism, but as a writer, as someone who's grappling with spiritual truths by means of symbol, he's almost unsurpassed. Notice in the Inferno, when he's writing about hell, he is not writing about what hell really is. He's symbolizing hell. He's symbolizing what it is to be without God. The punishments of the Inferno, I don't know if you've read any of it, they are symbols of the sin. For example, there's a sea of blood where the angry people are, or being punished for the sin of anger. What they're doing is to see a blood, and they're fighting each other. And they're biting each other, and they're yelling at each other, and they're mad at each other. Now notice, that's what they were doing on earth. Okay? In Dante, hell is the sin drained of all of the pleasure. And you see it in its ugliness, in its perversity, in its stupidity. But the people in hell are clinging to it. And that's their punishment. The people who betrayed loved ones, they're frozen in ice. They're isolated. Well, their hearts were cold. They rejected love. So if you reject love, well, you get what you want. Only when you get what you want and hold on to those evils, to that sin, it turns into something horrible. Anyway, that's what Dante's Inferno is about. Spenser and the Fairy Queen, a great Reformation writer. It's one of the greatest books that hardly anybody ever reads anymore. Everybody ranks Spenser right up there with Chaucer and the greats. Almost no one reads the Fairy Queen anymore. It's an allegory. In book one, he's symbolizing the Christian life. He's symbolizing holiness and the battles and how he loses his faith. And how when he loses his faith, he starts battling with knights called sans foi, which means without faith, leading to sans loi, to lawlessness. Just like the case of rejection of faith tends then to lead to lawlessness, and then to sans joy, to joylessness. And the knight is rescued. He's in a dungeon. The irony is, it's right about holiness, but whenever he tries to be holy by himself, he gets off the path and gets worse and worse. I mean, he's got to be saved by grace. And the images of rescue are unforgettable, some of the greatest poetry of the language. Begin picking up that symbolic tradition, this time to explore reformational truths. Then, of course, there was Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress. Masterpiece, writing about the spiritual life in symbolic terms. The tradition of romance. The romance tradition, only we have the word romantic and romance novel. The romances of the Middle Ages were basically adventure stories, stories about knights and dragons, and yes, love becomes a part of it, and magical adventures they had. The King Arthur romances, for example, very popular. And these, in effect, were fantasies, adventure stories, which often were carrying very important truths. In the 19th century, they rediscovered the romances. After the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, they looked down upon those because they were not logical. The Romantic movement rediscovered medieval literature. That's why they called it the Romantics, after romance, because people like Scott, Sir Walter Scott, were rediscovering the stories about knights and the whole medieval tradition, and bringing that into their own day. But in the 19th century, you had a flourishing of fantasy, many of the writers were Christians, people like George MacDonald, who influenced Lewis so much. People talking about the creative imagination, and Christians writing about this, seeing in human creativity a faint shadow of the divine image. God is creative. He creates the universe. We can be creative. We can create our own imaginary world. Not much compared to God. I mean, our worlds don't really exist. But again, seeing something valuable in that as tying into that divine image who's the source of everything that's good. Coleridge was a great pioneer of this and an important theorist of fantasy. Most people know Coleridge because he's a drug addict, which he was. What they don't know is that in his struggle with drug addiction, in his he couldn't just choose not to take drugs. He started reading Reformation theologians, and he became a Christian because he saw that his will was not free and that he needed to be saved by grace. You know, he said of Calvin, he said, Calvin is a lamb in a wolf skin. He said, on the surface, you know, you have a wolf in a lamb skin. Calvin's the opposite. He's a wolf in a lamb skin. On the outside, he seems so forbidding. Looks like a wolf, predestination and all that. But on the inside, it's a lamb. Because what that results is such comfort and assurance. Anyway, Calvinists should remember that. That may be helpful in explaining your position. But again, Coleridge, the great romantic writer, came around to those insights. Which gets us to 20th century Christian fantasy. Notice that the Christian writers, such as Tolkien and Lewis and Williams, they were writing in the modernist period. And notice, this is a great model for you, the way they related to the dominant culture. The dominant culture favored realism. So what were they writing? Fantasy. Okay. They were countering the dominant culture. They were doing the opposite of what the culture was doing, minding that other tradition. A lot of Christians think, well, whatever is fashionable, well, we got to do it too. Well, I mean, if you do that, you're just following. You're not going to have an impact. Other people are doing the same thing probably better than you're doing, and it looks like the Christians are just tagging along, hoping to be accepted. But the leaders who make the new art forms, the new styles, do something different from what everyone else is doing. And so Christian fantasy, people like Tolkien, he deals with the escapist issue very well. He said, hey, fantasy is an escape. Well, if you're in a prison, it's healthy to want to escape. And he said that people in the modern world were in a prison, that narrow, materialistic, that fantasy is the way to kind of blow the top off of that, to get people thinking in bigger terms, to come to grips with the possibility of spiritual kinds of reality. He created a world in Middle Earth. And he was a Christian in fact, he was the one who witnessed so much to C.S. Lewis, his friend, to help bring Lewis into the faith. It was Tolkien talking to him about the claims of Christ that brought Lewis in the most important and powerful Christian writers of our day. And of course, you know the Chronicles of Narnia. They're not just allegorical, they're fantasies. They're stories that he likes to tell. But as he does that, the worldview comes out and is crystallized in his stories. Another writer you should look at is Charles Williams. He's in that circle, Lewis, Tolkien, Williams, the Inklings. Williams is not read very much, but he is worth reading. In fact, I would say, anticipates magical realism before Marquez. You know, these very realistic stories and the realistic urban, you know, problems of modern people, and all of a sudden an archangel will appear. And again, it's so disorienting, but he really shows the spiritual realities impinging on ordinary life in his novels. You might start with Descent into Hell. Some are very difficult, kind of odd and strange, but very much worth reading, as realistic Christian fantasy. Now, a lot of 20th century fantasy today doesn't follow a Christian worldview. In our most modern age, all kinds of spiritual things. People are open to spiritual things, but a lot of the spiritual things are not good and not right. They do have a lot of fantasy dealing with the occult, with the New Age, with paganism. And again, that's a very big part of contemporary fantasy. And yet there's a Christian fantasy that's a great tonic to that. And other contemporary writers are Christian writers are using that. Well, in conclusion, think Christianly, but also use your imagination Christianly. The imagination, the ability to conjure pictures in our minds, that's an important part of us too. And in fact, that I think can affect our moral lives more sometimes than just abstract thinking. And there can be something very wholesome and healing and positive about cultivating the imagination in a Christian way. So as you're developing your mind, don't forget that part of yourself too, and bring that under Christ's rule. Thank you.